we live in a very scary time. In a very scary time. The three young men that were kidnapped on their way home for Shabbos after night seder on a Thursday night, last Thursday night, it's a punch in the face for us. That's really what it is. It's a punch in the face for anybody to realize that you cannot assume that everything is going to be the same tomorrow. That everything's just going to be fine, we're not going to have any problems whatsoever, we're just going to wake up tomorrow morning and everything will be okay. It's not like that, and we can never assume that. Honestly, the truth is that we should be living with a constant image in our heads. And that constant image should be boys tied up in a room with blindfolds on, which they cannot see and can't do anything. They're not able to do anything at all. Then having another image of those exact same boys being starved and beaten by Arabs who are doing this for no other reason than the fact that they hate Jews. They absolutely hate Jews. That's number two. And then number three, those boys possibly, chas v'shalom, never being able to see their families again, never being able to be outside again for the rest of their lives. We have no idea. We were lucky with Gilad Shalit. We're not always lucky with these types of things, and we don't always get everybody back. It's an unbelievable thought, but the image should be there. And if a person really, if we truly had that image in our head, if we went through and we put that image in our head of what it would be like to be captured by an Arab and to be thrown into a room never knowing what's going to be there, with psychological warfare. They tell them all the time, we just took over Israel, we just destroyed the army, we just did, you know, the Kotel is gone. They do this all the time to these kids, and these people have no idea what to think or what to do. It's psychological warfare that destroys, it knocks them down to the point of where they're left with absolutely nothing. If we really thought about that, we wouldn't be able to stop crying. And the honest truth is that if I was somebody of stature, and if I felt like we could actually do this and it would work, I would cancel the vacation for next week and say that we should all be in yeshiva next week. If I honestly felt it the way I should, it should be, what are we doing? We have to have an extra week and say we'll go an extra week more and say next week, let's learn for one full week just in honor of these boys. Just in honor of these boys, just to try to somehow get something for them. And who knows, maybe they won't get freed this year, but they'll get freed next year. But just to say that about us, there's no way you can sit back, relax, and just say that. We have to make a roshem, a real roshem. But I'm going to go a different route, and I'm obviously not taking away from anybody that's going to want to learn, or at least commit to learning 6.5 hours a week next week, every single day. 6.5 hours every single day. I'm not going to stop anybody from doing that. I think that's not only noble, but required for us in this day and age. But I'm going to say something else that should be able to be added on to this, and I would consider this to be a time of war. Now, it is not, this is not a normal war, and the truth is that the face of normative warfare has definitely changed drastically over the last few decades. There's no question that the way of war in the early 1900s, let alone the 1800s, is completely different from the way of war now by first world countries. I will agree that in Darfur and other places it might be the same exact thing, but in our world it's a different place. But this is a different type of war. This is a war of manipulation, of deceit, and trickery. And although I could hear an argument on this point, if we're looking for a comparison, something to compare it to, an analogy throughout the Chumash, I would compare it to Yaakov and Lavan, to Yaakov fighting against Lavan. Now, I understand that by Lot and Avram Avinu, you have a situation where Lot was stolen by the four kings. But in that case, the four kings were way more powerful than Avram Avinu, and Avram Avinu went in knowing he could possibly die and throwing dirt and turning it into arrows, having massive miracles happen. I don't know if that's the situation I would compare this to, when Eretz Yisrael seems to be the stronger hand against the Arabs, and the Arabs are grabbing something. Yaakov versus Lavan, however, of trickery, of deceit, of that type of idea, I think that's how you compare it to over here. And we have to act in a way that befits our stature as Jews, meaning keeping our pride, maintaining our dignity, while still expressing how upset we are that our enemies are doing what they're doing. And if we'd compare it to Yaakov and Lavan, then there's work to do. What do you do in a war of Yaakov versus Lavan? What do we as Jews take out of a war when it's Yaakov versus Lavan? And we know what Yaakov Inu did when he fought against Esau. That's already straight out Chumash, and we have Psukim. The Psukim say straight out that when he fought against Esav, he divided up the camps, got himself ready for war, and he davened. That's straight out. There's no questions about that, and those are straight out in the Psukim, and Rashi talks about it, the Midrashim talk about it, the Gemara talks about it. That's how we act when it comes to fighting against Esav. That's obvious. That's right over there. But very little, you can even say giving gifts, if you want to add that on as well, but very little is offered to us when it comes to a war of Yaakov versus Laban. What's there when it comes to Yaakov versus Laban? How to fight against an enemy like Laban? So we have to learn from the Psukim. So let's go to the Psukim. Rachel Imenu says to Yaakov, when he first meets him, you're not going to be able to defeat my husband, my father, Laban. You won't be able to become my husband. My father is a Ramai, a trickster, a liar, a shyster. There's no way you're going to be able to defeat him. And he said the line, and here's Yaakov in his line, Achivu Bramos. I am his brother when it comes to trickery. I am just as big of a trickster as he is. I'm just as big of a liar. I'm just as big of everything as Laban is. Now, we know Yaakovinu is the man of MS. That's what he's known for. The level of Tiferet, of something of combinations of Rachamim. That's the idea of what Yaakovinu stands for. It's strange that Yaakovinu says about himself that he could be a liar on the level of Laban HaRami, Laban HaRamai. To say that he's on that level is strange. Nonetheless, what's even stranger is that although that was his line to Rachamim, it seems that the exact opposite happens. He was fooled. He was fooled. He did a terrible job of tricking Laban. He said the line of Rachel Bitka Hakitana to try to get around everything, but nonetheless, he still married Leah. He still got tricked. He still seemingly looks like Laban is one that won, and even though he got Rachel afterward as well, it seems like that was just a consolation prize. That Laban was looking at it and saying, listen, you know, I tricked you completely, fooled you out of your mind. So the guy, alright, whatever, take Rachel also, it's not that big of a deal to me. It seems like, on the outside, that Yaakov was completely fooled, that there was nothing happening on his part of trickery, and that when he told Rachel, I'm his brother in trickery, we look back and we're like, well, apparently he wasn't. Apparently Yaakovinu had no trickery up his sleeve. He had absolutely nothing there. There wasn't even a rabbit in the hat. There was nothing that Yaakovinu was able to pull out to be able to trick Laban. But the truth is that Laban didn't get it. And Rachel Imenu may not have kind of gotten it. And to be honest, I'm not so sure how many people get it when they read the Psukim. But we're looking at it now, and we're looking at the Chumash afterward, and we're saying, you know, getting Leah was a pretty good deal. He got Malchus Beis David out of the deal from Yehuda. He got the Yisachar Zvulun relationship out of that deal. And he got Kuna and Leviah. Sheva Levi was from Leah. He got all of them, let alone the 8 kids that came from Leah and Zilpah. And then he also got Rachel, and he got Yosef Atzadik and Binyamin Atzadik, with Malchus based Yosef, or Malchus Ephraim, as well as the Malchus of Shaul HaMelech. There was something that Yaakovinu got, which they didn't realize at the time. Maybe at the time, Yaakov is the only one that got it. Yaakov is the only one that said anything. But you realize, at the end of the day, Yaakovinu got everything from Laban. He took everything away. He took away the 600,000 sheep that was Klal Yisrael away from Laban. The kids of Laban were complaining and saying, what's going on here? He keeps getting more and more and more. Nobody was getting it because Yaakov wasn't doing anything outright. All he was doing was looking up at a Kaddish Baruch Hu and saying, it's in your hands. Atzas Hashem Yisakum is what we say every single day in Yichavod. Atzas Hashem Yisakum. He literally put it in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands and he said, what's my trickery? Where's my ramos? What am I supposed to do? His silence. His ability to accept what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him, and not only accept it, but to say, this is number one. This is the greatest thing that could ever happen to me. Knowing that if he was tricked, so to speak, into marrying Leah, he knew, this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants for me. This is the plan. There's no, how could you do this? The screaming at Laban. We all expect you woke up in the morning, went over to Laban and started screaming, how could you have given me Leah? There was nothing of that. Nothing of that sort. Goes up to Laban and says, thank you, sir. May I have another? It's really what he did. And he got it. He got his other wife. 7 days later, he goes and he marries Rachel. Then works another 7 years for her. 7 years. And Laban is looking at her like, I'm the one who gains. I'm the one who gains. It took 14 years for Yaakovinu to get 600,000 sheep that he was going to eventually be able to call his own. It took another 6 years to pull out all the Kedusha from that. And again, we don't understand these things because we're fools. We look at the Chumash and we're just like, oh, sheep. And that's all we think. We're like, Yaakov Avinu is looking at this and he's saying, this is life. This is everything. Everything is right here. He won. He won everything. And at the end of the day, Laban goes home with no kids, no grandkids, none of the daughters. All of his sons died. His sheep were all dead. He goes home and he's the same person minus two, maybe four daughters, depending on Bilhah and Zilpah, as he was 20 years ago when Yaakov came to him in the first place. Remember that first line that Laban Arami said? You don't want to come here for nothing, Yaakov. So name me your price. Just name me your price. I just want a daughter. That's all I want. Didn't mention, and another daughter, and maybe another two daughters, and possibly grandkids, the 12 Shvatim. Those worked out nicely for Klal Yisrael. And then sheep, a lot of them, to stand for all of Klal Yisrael. So the Ramos of Yaakov was something completely different. Everybody knows what happens by Dina and Shechem. I mean, that's not a secret. Shechem comes to Yaakov. Can you imagine this? Shechem grabs Dina. And then says to his father, go get that girl for me. So they go up to Yaakov, and they say to Yaakov, we'd like to marry your daughter. And what does Yaakov do? Nothing. He just stares at them. Just looks at them. Until finally they felt uncomfortable and they turned away. But the Shvatim come by. And the Shvatim say, HaKizdona Yasach Hoseinu. Well, you want our sister? And then they use trickery in a different way. They go out there and they say, well, you should get first milas. And then the third day, they go inside and they kill and they do whatever what it was. And Yaakov looks at them, what are you doing? Why did you do that? They say, HaKizdona Yasach Hoseinu. Yaakov, again, is silent. Who answers back to their dad? Yaakov had a good taina. You just killed 24,000 people. That's a good taina. Now, granted, it was awesome because you're 13 and you're 14. So I do give it to you that 13 and 14-year-old going out and killing 24,000 people is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen before in my life. It was a crazy war, and those arrows were flying like mad. I hear that. That was unbelievable. You did have a little bit of an advantage. They didn't get first meal, but it was 24,000 people versus two. So yeah, I will give it to you on that one. I hear that this might have been one of the most unbelievable wars ever. And yet, Yaakov looks at him and says, no. Why? Why do you bother? No answer. No answer to Shechem. No answer to the Shvatim. No answer. Nothing. The one time the Yaakov did something wrong, Bikesh Leshev B'Shalva. Wanted to sit tranquilly and peacefully, thought everything was over, and that's when Rugzid Yosef came up. Yosef got sold, and he had 22 years of tzaras. Yaakov Avinu's not here. He's not with us. He's not like that guy down the street who's just like, hey, guys, want to go to Shalitz with me? He's not that guy. He's not that guy. I don't know if you should ever say yes to a random guy that says that to you. That's a story for another time. But he's not that guy. Yaakov Avinu had a plan the whole way through, and the plan was, here's the plan. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was in charge. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was in charge, and I don't understand a thing. See, here's what we have to work on. It's called the Emunah Pshuta. Now, I'm saying to myself, that's really easy for me to say when I'm not in the position of where these three kids are in. For me to say Emunah Pshuta when I'm 3,000 miles away and they're inside a basement somewhere being beaten by an Arab. Yeah, it's easy for me to say Emunah Pshuta. Just believe this is all for the best. I agree. It sounds ridiculous on my part to be able to say such a thing. Nonetheless, if I felt that way, and if I felt, literally, if I could get myself to cry over, and I'm not there yet, and I want to be, and eventually I will be, and I will get to the point where I can feel tsar that other people feel in Klal Yisrael, when I'm there, then I promise you, I'm going to say that the lesson is to be able to get yourself to the point where you're going to feel that tsar. For now, for us, and the people that are not on that level, that have not cried for these boys, that have not felt that feeling that's there, in that case, there's something else you need to work on. And it's to know that even though these boys went through a crazy lot, and even though we have no idea what they did, and I doubt there is much that they specifically could have done to deserve this type of a punishment that they're in, I will tell you without a question that this is all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in the end, we'll see it, we'll understand. Again, Lahavdil, a billion Havdalos. A billion Havdalos. That you can't even compare within the same category with the construction that's going to be going on the third floor. Rabbi Shuman asked me, what do I think about the construction? I said, what do I think about the construction? I think for right now, it's absolute Gehenna. for right now, it's going to be the worst thing that we're ever going to go through. And we're going to have problem after problem after problem. There's going to be issue after issue after issue. When it's done, I'm going to tell you it's awesome. When it's all done, it's all over, you know, in 2017, then I'm telling you that I'm going to look at it and I'm going to say, wow, this was unbelievably worth it. I'm so happy we did this. Great job. Unbelievably great job. But we are in the middle of it. When you're in the middle of it, you're the guy who is being affected. You're the one being thrown from a room to another room, to this, to that, to the other. When that happens to you, granted, at that time, it's not fun. At that time, it's terrible. And again, not comparing the terribleness, the first world problem of moving to a room, that huge room with three people, to a place of being beaten with air. Like, we're not even close to comparing the two. What I'm saying is that Emunah Pshuta takes many, many forms. And Emunah Pshuta in this form takes the idea of we have to realize, we have to know, this is the job of where we're at. This is a test from the Sasan. The fight of Yaakov versus Lavan is, are you willing to accept God's plan and say that something has to be done? Something has to be done, and it's going to be done by a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Is that what you're going to do? Or are you going to say, no, I don't accept it. No, I don't accept it. There's no way. And you either fight God, or argue with God, or you say it's not fair, or you do whatever it is. What do you do? That's where Emunah Pshuta comes into play. For these kids, there's nothing that you can say that they should do, or they could do, or they could have done better, or they would have done better. Nothing. You're not in that situation. There's nothing you can say. If you're their family, if you're close to their family, there's nothing you can say to them. That's like going to an oval, chas v'shalom, when he's sitting in a veilus and say, I'll tell you why this has to happen. Don't be a fool. Nobody knows these types of things. Nobody. But for the person who's in it, who's there, for us, in any situation that we're at, we have to sit there and we have to say to ourselves, there's got to be a plan. Otherwise, this world is just, it's Hefker. There must be a plan. Not only there must be a plan, we know that there's a plan. And we see it every time after everything's said and done. So let's use this. Let's put it into a bit of a... Let's make more of a microcosm. Instead of making a microcosm of the entire world and try to make it that way, let's take it into our personal lives and let's try to understand it this way. I used it for the dorms. That's one way to be able to understand it. But let's look at ourselves. I'm going through a lot of issues right now. Why am I going through a lot of issues? Well, I don't know if I should be ready to start dating yet. Or I'm dating. Or I'm engaged. Or I just got married. And in all those four situations, I'm running into problems. Why? Because I'm not sure if I'm ready to start dating yet because I know that I have taivas, but I'm not positive if this is the best thing for me in the position that I'm in right now. Right? I'm engaged. I'm dating. I know that I'm dating right now and it's great. The person that I want to be with is something like this, but it's not exactly. I don't know if this is the right person. Things are going badly. The parents don't like me. This and that and the other. But, you know, I'm going to work on it. Or, I'm engaged. Everything's going really well. But listen, there's so many money issues, and there's this and that and the other, and I can't believe that I haven't been able to speak to her, and then we got into a fight, and there's this and that and the other. That's that. Married. In which, listen, it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be so much better. I thought there was going to be this. I thought there was going to be that, etc. All those types of little issues that come in together, and it's not referring to any specific issues. I tried specifically to leave those out. But anything in which a person would be able to say to himself, where am I? What am I doing? You have to sit there and say to yourself, there's a plan here. Stop, think for a second and say, okay, so what's going to be, where am I going? How am I going to accept? And just be makabel. Be makabel. We're going to go through tzaras, and at the end, it's all going to be worth it. In the end, you're going to forget everything. We have an unbelievable memory. It's unreal, our memory, in which we're able to forget so many things. For example, the first 15 minutes of this schmooze. It's unbelievable what our selective memory is able to keep in and what it's not able to keep in. Think to yourself, where am I? What am I doing? What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu want from me? And if the answer is to accept His plan, no matter what it is, and even though I don't understand it, then you're going to be successful like Yaakov was. You'll get the 600,000. I don't want to say you'll get two wives. That's not a good thing. You'll get what you're supposed to get in this world. You'll get everything you're supposed to get and more. And you'll understand. There was something I'm supposed to get out of this. So at the end, honestly, obviously we have to daven. honestly, obviously we have to learn for these boys, and obviously we have to say Tehillim. I haven't been moved like that Tehillim session at Yeshurun in a long, long time. Probably 1,000 people there, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, that filled up the entire building on Sunday night. I was supposed to leave to go to a chavrusa, and I just couldn't leave. I didn't feel right leaving when there was that many people there all saying Tehillim together. And Rabbi Matenki got up afterward and said, it's so sad that we have to do this only for tzaros. We only have to do this for tzaros. The reality is, that's what brings us together. That's exactly the point here. Tzaros allows us to understand that there's a good thing, that a Kaddish Baruch Hu is really with us after the tzaros is over. After it's over and we realize there was a plan, there was something there. Why'd it have to happen that way? I don't know. Guys, why'd we have to go to Mitzrayim for 210 years and become slaves for 86 of them? But at the end of the day, we got Kriyas Yamsuf, which was awesome. We got the Makos, right, which is awesome. And then we got Torah. We had Matan Torah 50 days later. Would you trade? I'm not asking you now, because I don't think we fully understand it. Would you trade 86 years of slavery for getting Matan Torah, for being able to be at Matan Torah? Would you do that? Would you be willing to work as a slave for 86 years in order to receive the Torah at Har Sinai, seeing the Shekhinah, understanding that Moshe Rabbeinu got everything down? Would you trade that? And I'm not really asking the question, because all of you did. Your neshamas were all there. You were all either part there or spiritually there. You were all around during the times of the slavery and during the times of Matan Torah. So you were there. You all chose yes. You all said yes. So I'm not really asking that question. So there's no question. Daven, say Tehillim, learn for the boys, for them to be freed, for things to be easier for them, for us to be able to see them again. And soon, let it be today, let it be right now. There's no question you have to do that. No question. No question. But there's an added point to this. And the added point is to accept that this is all part of God's plan and hope that we don't have to go through such sorrows to get to God's official plan. That we don't have to have it, and that nobody from Klal Yisrael should have to have anything else. And Mashiach should come tomorrow. How many people really want Mashiach to come tomorrow? There's a couple Miami fans that probably didn't want until San Antonio beat Miami. There's a couple Blackhawks fans that didn't want until they lost to LA. There's a couple baseball fans who don't want it until the end of the baseball season. A couple Bears fans who are really excited about the upcoming season. This could be the year. Could be the year in the vein of the Cubs. Do you really want Mashiach? Do you really want it? Or are you planning? You're planning ahead for yourself, and you're just trying to see what's going to be. It's a thought process, and the whole summer should be about this. And we're going to end with this for right now. I want everyone to consider, to think to themselves, how could they better understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan? What do they have to do to work on their Emunah Pshuta? Simple Emunah, that what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is for the best. Whether you want to call it Kol David Rachmana L'Tav Avid, as Rabbi Kiva did, if you want to call it Gamzu L'Tova the way Nachum Yish Gamzu did. Think about what would be the idea behind this. Sorry, guys.